to From Believing to Being, a podcast about pursuing meaningful spirituality after faith deconstruction. We're your hosts.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Dave.
We're two former evangelicals having an ongoing conversation about what life and spirituality look like after letting go of our religious beliefs. Join us as we discuss deconstruction, Christianity, mysticism, enlightenment, and consciousness, and most importantly, how to experience this new way of being in the midst of parenting, careers, and going about our everyday lives.
If you've recently left your faith or simply feeling pulled into a deeper way of being, we hope this podcast will encourage and inspire you and really just reassure you that you're not alone on this journey. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another installment of the From Believing to Being podcast. And this is Karen and Dave back with you again. And this week, we're not exactly sure what we're going to talk about. we never really are, which is fun. But as we reflected before we hit the record button, the topics of mindfulness and attention come to mind. As we all know, those are pretty well talked about topics in this spiritual space. And for me personally, I've been really humming on this concept of mindfulness, especially in the last month or two. And one definition has particularly resonated with me, and it is from a mindfulness guru by the name of Jon Kabat-Zinn. So you may have heard of him. We'll leave some links to his work in the show notes, but he is well known for really bringing mindfulness to a more secular audience and approaching it more scientifically and really fusing the science and spirituality of it. He's close with a lot of the more spiritual mindfulness teachers, but also, again, approaches it from a more secular perspective. And so his definition is, and I think this is 25 to 30 years old now, it is: mindfulness is the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose in the present moment without judgment. So what we wanted to do today is just kind of break that down and talk through, what comes to mind when we think about just those key chunks of that definition. So, Karen, I'll turn it over to you. What are some of your first thoughts on that definition and just the general mindfulness attention type of topic? Like, what's been arising in your thoughts over the last couple of weeks regarding this?
So the first thing that comes to mind is, I think for a lot of people, our tendency is to want to be good at something and to want to latch onto something like, okay, I want to practice being mindful. And so this is what I need to do. I need to have the awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose in the present moment without judgment. And we want to try to take it all in one big bite and do it all at once. But because this is the first time that I've heard that definition, as you put it forth. And I like that we're going to go through it, because I think it's a little bit overwhelming, and you could really feel like a failure if you are trying to do it all at once. Like, oh, I'm not being mindful because I'm not judging, or I'm judging too much, or whatever. But that whenever you break it down, like, you can really begin to focus in on each piece and just practice one element of it at a time. And so I know for me, I think probably the first thing that I did, or that I learned how to do, was the without judgment part. That was probably one of the first things to go once I started deconstructing my faith, was this just loss of judgment piece. And it's definitely taken me a while to get to the paying attention on purpose and in the present moment part. So I just think it's a little bit overwhelming if you try to do it all at once. But if you see it as just practicing, you know, one piece of it at a time, then I think you'll get to a point where it all happens seamlessly.
Yeah, that's something I needed to hear, to be honest. Because yeah, I love the definition, but I wouldn't say that I'm overwhelmed by it. Although maybe I am, and I have a tendency to not realize I'm overwhelmed until it's like too much. but that's good to the way that you mentioned working on one at a time, and even yeah, like you said, reflecting on our own experience of historically, you know, like for me, what arises is, so again, to repeat the definition, and I'll say it slower with the chunks, right? So the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose in the present moment without judgment. And the big thing that arises for me is the paying attention part, because I've always been, ever since I was probably a teenager or younger, either I was told or I felt like I had some semblance of ADD, ADHD, and I just struggled to focus my attention. So I've always been drawn to meditation. As soon as I learned what meditation was, I was always drawn to that element of how, oh, it could help my brain with this thing of like the monkey mind, as a lot of spiritual traditions call it. So yeah, that paying attention piece has been a big point of focus for me. And so it's almost like I see the, you know, the past several years of my meditation and mindfulness practice and searching as cultivating that. And that, so I've done a good job of improving my kind of natural state with the attention piece. But then those other pieces, not so much, like you said, non-judgment. I feel like I'm just recently entering that element of it, where I actually will be aware of the thoughts that are happening or whatever is happening and have the intention of not having a judgmental response to it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so it is neat to be able to reflect and see these individual components of this set forth definition and when they've manifested in our life experience.
Yeah, you know, it's the paying attention part is interesting. And I don't know if that's where we want to start or, but just the way that you put it with the ADHD, for the longest time, I thought that being present or paying attention necessarily meant paying attention to everything else around me. That, you know, for example, that like being present with my kids meant being 100% focused on them. And for me, that was incredibly draining to try to be that way. And then it was actually a book that I was reading by Thich Nhat Hanh. Is that how you say his name?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And in it, it helped me. It was just like these little snippets of things from him, almost like a daily devotional kind of a thing. But he helped me to see that it wasn't necessarily paying attention to all the outward things, but it was paying attention inwardly. Almost like, I think you've said it before, like that being aware of being aware. You know, that.
Yeah.
And I've been noticing that a lot more. Like, can I, like, how present can I be? How much can I be paying attention to what is going on within me at the time, you know, whatever is going on around me? And it's strange. It's this sort of shifting from an externally out, like an externally focused attention to more of an inward focused attention. And I don't know. I think that that's, you know, that that's one of the things that meditation helps with, right? Is turning your focus internally and helping you not block out, but helping you find that place of being centered despite everything else that's going around you.
Yeah. Well, and the piece, I totally agree that it's easy to think of being present and, you know, mindfulness in general as the senses.
Right.
And that is definitely a part of it, but the senses, what are you seeing? What are you feeling? What are you hearing? What are you tasting? All that stuff is a critical component of cultivating this mindfulness. But what's often neglected is, as you said, what is happening internally? What is happening in your mind, especially? And because even body sensations is often talked about in mindfulness circles. You know, what are you feeling in your body? But it's less talked about in all of the different, whether it's books or podcasts or YouTube videos I've followed. There's less of an emphasis on what is actually happening in your mind. And what to do about that. Like, is it that you just, if you're practicing mindfulness, do you just do the meditation object where it's like, okay, just when you notice yourself thinking out of control, so to speak, unconsciously, as Eckhart Tolle would say, do you then just bring your attention back to something else, like your breath or some sort of object of your senses, some sense object, or do you keep your attention with whatever the thought is? And I think that's been a revelation for me more recently, is to just really stay with what is happening in the mind and allow it. And yeah, but the non-judgmental part becomes hard, because then you end up in thought spirals where you'll make right. a judgment about it, and you'll make a judgment about your judgment. But I think it can be so helpful to just understand a couple of things. One, how, speaking for myself, but I understand a lot of others will say the same thing, how relatively insane our thoughts can be. Just like all over the place. Like, where the heck did that thought come from? Or what is that? So realizing the kind of the, again, the monkey mind, but then also gaining insight into what is there, you know, what is under the surface, and, you know, and going from there. I mean, I think that's where the quote unquote inner work comes in. Once you start to become aware of what's happening under the surface, you can start to maybe make changes. But that goes into another thing that we had talked about in the beginning of, you know, how do we evaluate the thoughts, right? So we want to try to seek a non-judgmental perspective, but in some cases, there is probably some sort of evaluation that comes in, right?
Right. Yeah, we were talking about that. Like, what... if we're not our thoughts and we're not our feelings, what thoughts should we pay attention to over others, right? And I think, I mean, I like going here, because it's so often in these non-dual spirituality circles, you know, it's like from the Christian perspective, right? We're taught to, what's that verse? Like, to take captive our thoughts, right? And then from the non-dual perspective, it's, well, you're not your thoughts, you're not your feelings. And so in that case, you know, well, are we supposed to have any thoughts at all? What thoughts are good thoughts? What thoughts are bad thoughts? And I know Spira and Muji and Toll, all those guys, they've talked about using the mind as a tool. And then it becomes like, okay, well, how do we do that? And for me, I've tried to think of, you know, it is, I mean, kind of going to the next one, the part that says on purpose, you know, that mindfulness is the awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose. You know, what thoughts do we have that are actually intentional and deliberate and and controlled, you know, very, just very intentional versus the thoughts that just run wild or maybe that come up without you having that intentionality behind them. I mean, you know, some people will say like a trigger is a good example, right? Just, you know, your kids do something and instantly you're just like, bah! and you lose it. And your first response is anger. Well, that anger is not an intentional thought. That anger is just like a gut reaction, right? And that's why if you can take the time to count to 10 or do whatever to calm yourself down, then you can have an intentional approach to the situation. And so I think that's for me where I try to differentiate between like, okay, what thoughts are trying to run wild and just be kind of those gut reaction thoughts versus, you know, I'm sitting here at my computer, I want to write a blog post. And so I'm intentionally thinking about what I want to say and how to write it and that kind of thing. So I think that for me has at least been one of the first steps is just that gut reaction, not thinking versus being intentional and deliberate. How about for you?
Well, I think that this is a great example of the value of this, right? Because, you know, so far we're kind of talking about the technical elements of mindfulness, but what we haven't talked about is the why. And I think, you know, we've probably danced around that a lot in prior episodes, prior conversations about presence, things like that, and why it matters. But I think that this is why cultivating a mindfulness practice is important, because the more that we can become aware of exactly what you just said, where the thoughts are coming from, do they serve us? I watched a video about it, mindfulness in general the other day, and I think he used a different term as well that resonated, but I can't remember what it was. But he said that, does it serve us? And thinking about thoughts that arise, because sometimes spontaneous thoughts can come and they may serve us, right? It's like, oh, that's interesting. But then if we really reflect on it, it's like, I didn't will for that thought to happen. It just spontaneously came versus like you're saying, like, I want to think of a pink elephant. And I'm going to think of a pink elephant, right? I want to think of a process more practically. I want to think of a process. I want to think of this problem and how to solve it. You know, more willful thoughts. But to be able to be the awareness, and that's where I think the non-dual path helps, is embodying that essence, that entity that isn't the thought, that isn't any of the contents of the experience, but is the one that is aware of the thoughts. You know, I go back to what Eckhart Tolle is famous for and how he started his book, The Power of Now, where he had essentially suicidal thoughts. You know, he wanted to end his life. And then he just suddenly woke up to the realization. It's like, wait, who is it that is noticing these thoughts? Right. And that is the essence of so much of this, is realizing, wait, these thoughts are coming and these thoughts are giving me suffering, causing me to suffer, creating suffering, maybe the best way to say it. And realizing, oh, I am the one aware. And the more we can cultivate that, the more, to go back to your example, the more we can realize, wait, these thoughts came of anger towards my kids or at work, or to somebody who cut me off in traffic. That happens to me every single day, basically, nowadays. And realizing, oh, like, I can just notice that thought and just let it go. I don't need to sit with it. I can just notice it, let it be, and just return to the groundedness of just pure awareness. The awareness that arises through continually cultivating this mindfulness practice.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the attention piece I mean, I've been thinking about that a lot, and I was sharing with you earlier this thing that I, this idea that I had, which I can't claim is 100% original. I don't remember where I might have got it from, but it feels like mine.
Everything is a remix.
Right? Everything is a remix. Nothing new under the sun.
Right.
My kids and I have been studying sound in homeschool and also studying space, and not necessarily together, but one of my sons asked, because we were talking about how sound needs a medium to travel through. And, you know, in our atmosphere, we have fairly tightly packed particles. And so sound works off of vibrations. That's a whole like sound wave idea, right? It's like you drop a pebble in a pond and the waves spread out in all directions. And it's the same thing with sound. Like you speak and the waves just kind of go everywhere unless you angle them. So it needs particles to bounce off of, to vibrate off of. And in space, there aren't any of that. So one of my sons said, well, what happens if you say something in space? Like, do any words come out? And so we had this conversation about how, you know, space is a vacuum. Like there's, you know, all the particles in space tend to get sucked in by gravity into planets or black holes or whatever. And so basically there aren't any particles in space or not enough of them for sound to bounce off of. And so if you, like, you can move your lips, like in theory, if you could actually like survive in space to move your lips to speak, sound wouldn't come out because there's no medium for it to travel through. Anyway, my little insight with this was that, you know, if we think of awareness as being like space, then the medium that we would have for like for our thoughts and our feelings would be our attention. And so with our attention, you can even think of attention as like a spotlight, right? You know, you're shining your spotlight at one point on, you know, oh my gosh, how awful my life is, you know, on all these thoughts. You're giving your thoughts this medium of your attention to go through, like, oh, my life sucks. I hate my job. You know, I have bills to pay, blah, 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 blah. But then let's say that you start to smell smoke and your fire alarm goes off. All of a sudden your attention swings over to like, oh my God, I got to get everybody out of the house. Like, we got to go now. And you totally forget about all of those thoughts of like how much your job sucked or whatever, right? Your attention is that medium. And for me, that was a helpful way to look at it, because exactly like what you're saying, you know, we have thousands and thousands of thoughts that go through our head every day, but yet there's only a select few that we zero our attention in on or that grab our attention. And obviously if something grabs our attention, that's, you know, one, we're giving more power to that thought, like we're not taking full ownership, but it's something that we can look to be like, oh, why do I get mad every time I get cut off in traffic? Like, what is catching me? What is hooking me right there? Because clearly something is hooking me. It's grabbing my attention. Or if we tend to, you know, or the other way, if we tend to focus our attention on how much, you know, how much I hate my body or how much I hate, you know, my situation or how afraid I feel when something happens, then we can, you know, we can ask ourselves the questions of like, well, why is it that thought out of all of the thousands that we have? Why is it that thought that I am choosing to offer this medium of my attention? Like, why, you know, whereas other thoughts just kind of like get cut off, like sound in space. You know, you drive past a dog, you're like, oh, look, there's a dog. Boom, it stops, you know, and then something else happens. Like, oh, why did that, you know, what's there? So, I like that idea that our attention, you can give energy to a thought via your attention, or you can take energy away by not giving the thought any more attention. And then the question for self-inquiry purposes becomes like, well, why do I give a particular thought more attention and energy than another one? What is it that hooks me in?
I love that. And I had no intention of doing this, but it actually flows very well with what you were just saying. So when I Googled the mindfulness definition by Jon Kabat-Zinn, it's what we've already said, the awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose in the present moment without judgment. But then the definition on Google says, per Jon Kabat-Zinn, he says, sometimes I add, quote, in the service of self-understanding and wisdom.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is exactly what you were just saying. I think that's perfect, because absolutely, that is one of the key goals, I think, is to realize what are the thoughts that are arising? What are the thoughts that are causing us suffering? Because really, the way I think of thoughts is it's the lens through which our experience happens, unfortunately. I mean, and I think mindfulness seeks to turn the volume down and just be aware of the experience without that narrator in the mind. But as we all know, that's extremely difficult to do. And in some cases, not practical, because like you said, the mind is a tool to help us engage with the world. And a personal example actually comes to mind in terms of what you're saying and how experiences can lead to thoughts that lead to like that self-inquiry, sort of like self-understanding maybe. So I had this experience recently where somebody in a position of authority over me was very kind of spoke down to me, like kind of what I felt like was treating me like a child in a way. And I like internally like lost it. Like it was the most upset I've emotionally felt in like a direct response to something in a long time. And I just remember, obviously, yeah, bringing in the experience of how this individual was communicating to me and my thoughts going crazy about the response to it. And then afterwards reflecting and asking those questions, like, why is it that I have this hyper focus? Like you mentioned the fire, mm-hmm. right? Why is it that my psyche, my attention goes all to this precise experience and everything else in the world is shut out? What is it about me? You know, and it kind of opens up inner work in a way to ask the questions and almost do your own self-therapy to be like, you know, what was it that maybe I went through as a child or other traumatic experience I might have had that causes me to have such a extreme response to something like this? Mm-hmm. And for the record, I don't have, for my own experience, I don't have the answers to that. But it's exciting to me from a personal perspective to have that more mindfulness around it, right? To accept the fact that, like, yes, I was very, very upset and I am okay with that. And I'm using it as a tool to better understand who I am and what has led me to be where I am now. Mm-hmm. But again, it all kind of goes back to that part of the definition of paying attention on purpose and really having that cultivated awareness of what is happening in the mind, even when these kind of extreme emotions arise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that example because I know attention seems like such a powerful tool to me because on one hand, if you can learn to control your attention, you can turn it away from the things that you don't want to pay attention to, right? You know, you can be like, or you can at least say, I can't pay attention to that right now. I need to focus on this over here. And so I'm going to have to deal with that later, whatever, right? You can just have more mental control over your brain. But also one of the things that was just incredibly transformative for me when I was writing, you know, when I was working on this, on writing this book about having had an abortion, I was intensely focused on one of the most difficult periods of my life. I was hyper-focused on it. Like you said, I had gotten to a point where I felt so imprisoned by the shame and just the internal dissonance that I felt over it, that I was like, I have to deal with this. I cannot continue to feel this way anymore, this trapped. And so my way of working through it was to write it all out. And what I found was that my attention was so completely, deeply focused, hyper-focused on that time in my life and that experience, that essentially what ended up happening is that it all dissolved. All of the shame and all of the guilt and the fear and everything surrounding that ended up dissolving. And in my mind, it almost feels like, you know how the sun, when it's magnified, you know, if you take a magnifying glass, mm-hmm. obviously whatever's underneath the magnifying glass is going to look huge. It's going to look huge. And, you know, if it's a spider or something, you might be like, oh my God, I'm afraid of that. And there's a sense, if it's on your own personal life, if you're magnifying something in your personal life, there is an intensity, there's a fear, there's kind of this sense of like, I don't want to go there. But if you can hold your focus there, your attention there long enough, it'll burn up, it'll dissolve, and you'll see that it's really not as scary as it was, that it's actually, you'll be able to see it for the illusion that it is. And so I think, I mean, that's one of the other benefits of meditation, right? Is supposed to be that you can go to a difficult sensation and you can allow yourself to breathe through it, right? And actually, like, I was shocked to hear that this is actually what yoga was designed to do. Yoga is all about putting yourself physically into a difficult position, holding it, and learning how to breathe through it. And so meditation is sort of like that for you emotionally, and yoga was traditionally that physically.
Interesting. Yeah, that's I'd never heard that about yoga before. I love it, and it's funny because I've definitely like hurt myself doing yoga before, and I'm like, and I always end up having this like literally as we speak right now in the present moment, I'm paying attention in the present moment. Here we go. but I have like a weirdly inflexible right leg. It's kind of weird, and so I was contorting it in such a way that it ended up, you know, causing me pain. So it's funny because now the judgment is, ugh, this sucks. Like, screw yoga. Like, I have to deal with now this more recurring knee pain after I did that. It's been like a month or so. And, but then to go back to what you're saying is, can I just accept this as part of the experience and breathe through it even after, right? So it's like you have the pain of doing the yoga. And not that you should ever like willfully allow yourself to be injured through yoga, but if you do hurt yourself in some respects, that's good. That's very insightful, because I think a lot of times, you know, I have a handful of other like kind of chronic ailments. It's nothing severe, but it's like these mild discomforts, and it is like a good practice for this stuff to not resist it, because it's so easy to get upset about like, oh, I'm so sick and tired of these uncomfortable, unpleasant sensations in my body that you resist. Mm-hmm. So that's really insightful to think how the physiologically we can change by bringing our attention to something and allowing it to be rather than fighting it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean,
I'm not a doctor, so I can't speak to the actual practical implications right? of that, but it's an interesting exercise nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's why, you know, a lot of times in meditation, meditation, if you do the guided meditations, right, that's a fantastic, super simple way to learn about your attention, because they'll say, turn your attention to the breath, right? Focus on your sit bones or whatever. Or they'll, you know, they'll do like a body thing of, you know, bring your attention to your toes, bring your attention to your eyebrows, different things to teach you that you can guide your attention. It's not always easy at first, but you can, you know, move your attention around your body. And then in yoga, it just is, it's sort of unspoken. I mean, you get into a, you know, into a weird position and there's no part of your body that likes it. But if you can relax into it and just try to find your breath in it, that's like, okay, look at me. I'm in a difficult position that I really don't like, that is super uncomfortable. And yet I can still breathe. Like I can still survive. Right. It's an interesting thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to, well, if you don't mind, I wanted to go back to the, I love the analogy of the magnifying glass, the beam of sun that burns up, you know. It's going to make me sound sadistic, but I think as a kid, I probably did that with ants.
Sure.
I'm sure a lot of kids probably do that, but in hindsight, it's kind of sad to kill a living being like that. But anyway, right. So I think it's a great, all violence aside, it's a great example, or like maybe, you know, done it with a leaf or something like that. But it reminds me of, again, something that Eckhart Tolle helped me understand is, so he uses the words consciousness and unconsciousness a lot in his teaching. Mm-hmm. And while he may not say that what we're talking about is attention is the same thing as consciousness, he would probably argue that attention is the doing of consciousness, something right, of that sure. respect. And basically what he says is that when you devote your consciousness to something that is unconscious, which could very well be these emotional disturbances that are causing us pain that we want to avoid, i.e. keep it in the unconscious, we transmute it into consciousness. And right, I think that kind of correlates with this is that, so you think about that object under the magnifying glass, whatever it may be, to use the emotional piece, it's some sort of traumatic, uncomfortable emotion that we want to just go away, but we don't want to pay attention to it. We just want to avoid it. Mm-hmm. But when we take that magnifying glass and let the sun shine onto it, that sun of attention, of consciousness, it burns up whatever that negative emotion is, and then what remains? Mm-hmm. I think that's the key piece. It's not like, okay, now it's dissolved and everything's great. It's like what remains on that little spot is the sun. That consciousness, right? The more essence of what we are. So it's like the more that we find these little, and it goes back to two episodes ago, you were talking about what is unenlightening us. It's those things, right? Things that are causing blockages from us to return to that state of equanimity and just mindfulness of just being aware of what is in our surrounding and finding a, I don't know, there is a joy there. There's a joy in just having a raw experience of life. Mm-hmm. But so often these things get in the way and they become bigger and bigger and bigger until we can bring our attention to them and shrink them, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
Every time that I that I think about this, like I always think of it in terms of going in, like a trigger is sort of a voice calling from the deep, like, hello, I'm down here. Mm-hmm. You need to come and free me and like bring me into the light. And the picture that always comes to mind is, have you seen Harry Potter 4, The Goblet of Fire?
I think the real question is how many times, and to which my answer is, I don't know. I've lost count.
Okay.
I'm a big Harry Potter nerd, for the record. I love it. Okay. Yes, I have seen it.
So the movie, the way that the movie portrays it is really fantastic. So in, they have this series of events that they have to complete in a competition for the big prize. And so one of the things,
the Triwizard Tournament.
The Triwizard Tournament, thank you. So one of the events is that a person that they love has been enmagicked and put in the bottom of the moat or the lake that surrounds Hogwarts, and they have to figure out a way to go down and to retrieve their treasure, right? That's like the code, whatever, the clue. They have to figure out a way to go down into the lake to retrieve this. And so, you know, all of the Harry and the others in magic themselves to swim, to be able to swim somehow and hold their breath underwater. And Harry, you know, goes down and he has to battle all the lake creatures in order to get there. And when he gets there, he realizes that there are multiple people down there that he, but only one that he's supposed to save. Anyway, long story short, he releases them all, but he's like losing his magic. And so he could drown. He could die. Right. So it's incredibly hard for him. It's very painful. He's exhausted. And yet he drags his friends up. And then at the end, it shows him like pushing them up out of the water, and like everybody claps. And there's this huge, like he takes this big breath. It's like, oh, you know, like he did it. And everyone is joyful. And, you know, everybody's cheering and everything. And I kind of feel like sometimes the things that trigger us, those things that we've put under the magnifying glass, that it's like this incredibly painful, awful experience to go through. But then whenever you bring them into the light and like you say, like the sun is the thing that is left. There is this feeling of joy and like I did it. I went through something really hard. I revisited this incredibly difficult, you know, trauma or whatever that I've been hiding for so long. And now it doesn't have any more power over me. It's in the light. It's free, right? Like it's being released. It's come into the light. It's been enlightened, right? Like that's the whole thing. So anyway, long story. That's what I always think about with that. Is like I imagine myself as Harry Potter going down and then like bringing them up to the light. Like, yes, look, it was hard, but I did it. There is a strange joy.
Yeah, that's a great. It's amazing the power of these stories, right?
I know. Yes.
It's what am I thinking? Oh, you know, Joseph Campbell was really. I keep telling myself I need to. He's one of those influences that I need to probably devote more time and attention to what his work. Mm-hmm. Someday I will. It's on my list. But yeah, what he talks about with the power of myth and how there's just these recurring themes, and mm-hmm. I think that's beautiful because that is psychological, sociological wisdom that it just really cuts to the nature of being human. I mean, and what's arising for me as I think about that story. And what we're talking about is freedom, that perhaps, you know, as we think about what is it that we as human beings desire as a collective, as individuals, it does seem like freedom. And sometimes it takes that going down into the depths, listening mm-hmm. to that triggering voice. Like you said, I think that's a really insightful way to look at it is when you get triggered, it's a voice telling you to go deep. And then coming up to the surface is a freedom, that you are freed from whatever it is that was down there, whether it takes a week, a month, a year, several years, it's the healing journey. But then it's freedom. And I think that then with freedom, there is just a joy, right? I mean, think about someone, and it's probably not a perfect example, but someone that has been imprisoned for years and is suddenly, you know, free. Like, what is that feeling like? Because I think we all experience it, right? We are imprisoned by these deep-seated traumatic emotions that some everyone has trauma of some sort that's stored deep within their emotional framework. What would it be like to be freed from that? And that's what I love about this mindfulness, is because these are things that we don't often realize are even there until a triggering event happens.
Yes, right.
Often.
Yeah.
But the more we practice mindfulness, the more we can maybe have a little bit more foreknowledge about what's down there. It doesn't require a triggering event. And I'll just give one example of something that I experienced yesterday. And for the record, I'm still trying to figure it out. But I've had these more periodic noticings of like a feeling of uneasiness. I'll suddenly realize like I feel uneasy. There's something really strange happening under the surface, and I'll have no idea what it is, but there's something there, and I'll just notice it, and I'm like, huh, I wonder what that is. And then I'll spend the time to like reflect and be like, what are the thoughts deep down that might be stirring this? And it's kind of neat, because again, it's not a trigger. There's nothing like, oh, I'm so angry about this, that, or whatever. It's just a feeling of uneasiness. And I credit stuff like that to practicing more meditation and mindfulness, because I'm more likely to notice it and give that on purpose piece, right? I notice it. Oh, let me on purpose pay more attention to it. And what's the other word that he used? Self-understanding. How can I use this as a point of self-understanding?
Right. And I think too, that the more times that you go there, the more that you investigate, the more courageous you become, because you start to see that there's, you know, it's that the only thing to fear is fear itself, right? That there's, that the fear that you have around something is actually just, like, it used to be a protective mechanism, right, for our ego, because we weren't emotionally mature enough to deal with whatever the trauma was. But then you reach a point where that fear is no longer serving you, and you're like, okay, I have to go there. I have to do something about it. And so you go and you go through it, and you know, focus the magnifying glass until the whole thing burns up. And then the next time that you have a trigger, it's like, okay, I've done that before and I survived. I can do this. I can face this, whatever it is. And then you just become more and more courageous. And I think that that's part of what, you know, these other non-dual teachers talk about, when they can say like, oh, a thought can rise up and they can just dismiss it right away. Or like the ego can rise up in a, you know, in some way, and they can just dismiss it because they've recognized it for what it is, that it's just an illusion. It's, you know, and so, but that I think comes from doing this work and just recognizing the triggers for what they are, and then developing, like building up the courage and the, like the emotional and mental fortitude to keep going down there. And once you go down there, you're like, oh great. Okay. Here's another thing that I got to pull up and, you know, shove to the light. And it ceases to become this really huge thing. It just becomes part of like your normal routine, and doesn't feel like this massive elephant, you know, that you've shoved in the closet. And you're like, oh God, I have to deal with that. It just, you do that, you know, you do have to deal with that a couple of times, but then it becomes easier and easier as you start to see it for what it is.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I think a way to look at that is to say, you know, these individuals who are living embodiments of this, the fruits of this spiritual path, meditation, mindfulness, self-inquiry, etc. They are probably, excuse me, they're probably individuals that have just really gone deep enough and faced those demons enough and had the experience to realize everything you're saying, that so much of this is illusory, and cutting through all of that to allow the sun to be all that really is. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because we talk about the direct path, and I think in some respects the direct path can be really misleading, and I think I don't want to say dangerous because that's a little bit too hyperbolic maybe, but misleading because I think some can assume that you realize you are the sun, you know, the sun is the true essence of reality, and all this other stuff is just appearances within that reality. And so you can just be the sun and ignore all the rest. And the other, to trace it to the Hindu tradition of Advaita, they call that Neo. I think it's Neo Advaita, where, and maybe we've talked about that on the podcast before, but basically, like, you, once you realize the truth of the non-duality, the oneness, that's it. Mm-hmm. You've realized it, and that's it. You just rest in that, and there's no more work to be done. So it's tricky because I can understand why, I can understand the logic behind that, to realize, well, that is what we are. So everything else is just fleeting, temporary, illusory, and doesn't really matter. We can just kind of let it be and just continue to rest as consciousness, as awareness. But, and I think I've personally fallen into that a little bit. But I think as I gain more experience in just kind of swimming in this sea of non-duality, the more I realize that these triggers and that the deep-seated negative emotions, painful emotions, are still there, and we are going to find a liberated experience if we can do the work to bring them to the surface, like you said, that the Harry Potter example, like if we can bring those things up to the surface and put the light on them, there is pain, right? And that's, I get another good part of that example, like Harry in the story was going through pain, almost died. Mm-hmm. But in the end he brought things to the surface and there was a joyous celebration because everyone was liberated from, you know, the environment where they couldn't breathe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, as you were talking, I was looking at the mindfulness definition again over here in the chat, and I was thinking that the direct path, so you can actually almost like see it in the definition, the direct path is starting with awareness and then almost like developing all of those other characteristics, the paying attention, the on purpose, the present moment, the without judgment, that the direct path is realizing I am awareness. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, letting all of those other things fill in, like what it means kind of to be the awareness, whereas self-inquiry is almost starting from the back end, because I feel like I got to this point starting from that back end, that I dropped my judgments first, and then I learned about, you know, what it means to be in the present moment. I started practicing that on purpose, and then that has led me to being in that place of just being, which is the paying attention and the awareness. And so let's jump to the without judgment. And I want to talk about that too, because for me, like I said, like that was a huge thing. And deconstruction, like when I dropped my religious beliefs, I would say probably 85 to 90% of my racing mind dropped out. Like, it was so weird. It was almost like overnight. I went from having a mind that was constantly chattering away to having a mind that felt almost empty. Like, I was worried because I felt like emotionally I felt more empty, and also just mentally I was like, I feel like I couldn't think. It was so strange. And what I realized later, kind of like looking back at my experience, is that, you know, the majority of our thoughts are judgments. I should be doing this. I need to be doing that. Why can't I be more like this? You know, why didn't I do that? Like, just all of our thoughts are judgments. And even thinking like, oh my gosh, that, you know, that person is such a jerk, or like, oh, that was so nice. I mean, we're constantly judging things. I need to do more around my house. Like, oh shoot, I forgot about, all of the thoughts in our head, the majority of them are judgments. And for me, you know, my entire life, I mean, I was raised in a Catholic, you know, in a Catholic family. I mean, we were going to church since I was little. I was always had religion like overhanging my experience. And so I had decades of conditioning, of religious conditioning that informed the judgments that I had. So it was always like, oh, I need to be a better example of Christ for my atheist husband. I need to be a less angry mom. How are my kids ever going to know that Jesus loves them if I'm yelling all the time? I mean, I was all of my, you know, I mean, the majority of my thoughts were informed by these religious judgments of what it meant to be a good Christian, what it meant to be pleasing to God, what it meant to be a good example of my faith, what it meant to be living out the fruits of the Spirit, you know. And whenever I dropped all those religious beliefs, that's why my thoughts quieted down, is because they had all been fueled by those religious judgments that I had. And so, you know, I mean, that's one thing that I think is interesting, is like, to, you know, to recognize what, I guess from this way, now that I look at it, it's like, okay, well, what are the influences over me now? Like, what are the social influences that are fueling my thoughts? Like, right now it's, you know, it's a super big deal to be really PC, to be very pro social justice. And so I've noticed, you know, whenever I go to post something or to write something, I have this little voice that is saying like, oh, make sure that you're not being ableist. Make sure that you're mentioning your privilege. You know, should you be saying this as, you know, as a upper middle class, you know, white female, like all of these little judgments. And how do you let those go? Like, how, you know, I don't know. So that for me, that part about without judgment, I feel like that's where I started. And I do think it's so important to recognize what things are influencing your thoughts, like the overall topic. And then, you know, how can you recognize that and step away from them?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the non-judgment part is tricky for a couple of reasons. But I guess the first thing that comes to mind as I think about this is the how it can be a good indicator of where our ego is attached, or ooh, I guess yeah, that's not the right way to say mm-hmm. it, to where our ego is manifesting. Because again, the more I've kind of pondered all this and learned about it, like, I've come pretty comfortable with the notion that the ego is an illusion that is constructed through thinking. It is this sense of self that isn't real. It's mm-hmm. how we see the source of our experience that is ultimately an illusion. Mm-hmm. And then these judgments can often point to where that sense of self, yes, that illusory sense of self is. So in your example, the worrying about or the judging of the experience, where how will others see me?
Yes, the belonging. This? Yes.
Yeah, that is a judgment. So it's almost like, again, not that it's good or bad. I don't know that the good or bad spectrum is valuable here, but is it mindful? Is it mindful or not? And again, this great definition helps to understand that allowing those judgmental thoughts can be argued that it's not mindful. Mm-hmm. And again, not necessarily good or bad, but mindful or not. So I think that's a good way to look at the, you know, it's good to look at, okay, what is causing our judgments, but also what is our judgment pointing at?
Right.
You know, like you mentioned earlier, that the triggers can be a voice calling to for our attention, but I think also our judgments can be the same way.
Absolutely.
The other thing that arises for me as I think about this judgment part of the definition is that I think some judgments are absolutely necessary. The reason I say that is because I think I've been very drawn to mindfulness questions, meaning making a judgment about the thought, if that makes sense. So,
right.
For example, is it true? That's making a judgment, but it's a very helpful judgment. Because if we have a thought pattern happening and we stop and bring mindfulness and attention in the present moment on purpose to that thought, and we just ask the question, well, is it true? No. Okay, well then move on. Let it go. Mm-hmm. If it's not true, it's not worth continuing to fuel it and energize it. That realization of something is false can really cause it to dissolve quickly. Mm-hmm. And there's other thoughts like, is it helpful? Is it relevant? I find myself asking that question periodically. Like I'll have a thought and it may not relate at all to like what I'm actually doing in the moment. Like, so maybe it's important, but like, it's not relevant to this very moment. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think it gets a little muddy perhaps with mindfulness is like, how do we define, how do we judge the judgments, right? What judgments are good? What judgments are helpful? What are not? And I guess just realizing maybe what it comes back to is conscious versus unconscious judgments. Like how often do we make these unconscious judgments where we're not actually asking a question and trying to answer it? It is a judgment about a situation that is arising without even really thinking about it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think those questions too are going to be different for every person. I mean, I think that there are, you know, are some questions. Like for me, the question of is it true isn't necessarily helpful, but can I know for sure that it's true? Like, you know, can I, like that sort of thing, just a slight twist on it is more is more helpful to me. And also different stories. Like for me, you know, I'm very clear with my kids that like I try really hard not to talk to them in terms of good or bad. And, you know, I try not to say like, oh, you know, just, you know, be good, or, you know, think in terms of I want them to be a good person or to have good behavior, just because nothing is 100% good or bad. It's all in the, like we talked about this before, right? It's sort of all in the individual perception. Just like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? I feel like good or bad is in the eye of the beholder in so many ways. And so I try, you know, for myself, I think I'm because I started with the dropping the judgment, for the most part, I feel like it's become a lot more like seamless for me to figure it out. But I do catch myself sometimes just being like, is that what I want to think about? Kind of that, like, is this really serving me? like, or, you know, or asking that, like, the, you know, the other question of where is this coming from? Like, what is this? You know, is this my ego lashing out because I'm not getting the attention that I think I deserve? Okay, that's me being ridiculous. Like, just, you know, just go on. I think those questions are going to be different, but the important thing is to ask them. The important thing is to be investigating every single judgment that you have, to, you know, to be skeptical about it. And I think what's helpful to you there, and what's necessary maybe, is even that recognizing that you're not your thoughts. And because you're not your thoughts, you can look at them and you can question them without feeling like, you know, your own identity is being questioned. You can be more of an objective observer of your thoughts. And I think the helpful thing there is, you know, if you're in the shower and you have some crazy song going through your head that pops into your head, you don't identify with that. You're not like, oh, this is, you know, this is who I am. But then you have the thought of, oh, I hate my body, or I'm mad at, you know, my spouse or whatever, and you latch onto that one, then you can start to question, okay, why do I do that? why am I picking this one? And it helps you to see that, like, you're not actually your thoughts, because you're very deliberately, like, choosing to focus on ones and not the other. But then that also enables you to step back from all of them and to be objective about them, and to recognize where you're judging one thought as being superior or more important than another thought. And you're like, okay, I've judged that one as more important. Well, what judgment do I have that is saying that that one needs to be more important? Like, oh, well, the judgment behind the judgment is that, you know, wives are supposed to be submissive to their spouse. And right now I'm feeling resentful towards my spouse. And so therefore I'm judging myself more harshly for being resentful because I'm supposed to be submissive. It's like this whole, you sort of have to walk yourself back of like, okay, I'm judging this thought. Why? What's the judgment behind that judgment? What's the judgment behind that judgment? And exactly like what you were saying earlier, that our judgments all can point to an area where our ego is trying to build itself up, or, you know, a trauma that we've, I don't know, but mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your example there brought my attention to maybe even another way to look at this. And we've got, we're probably at time here, so we can wrap up with this kind of theme, I guess. But is that if we look at the end goal of this mindfulness, it's in the definition, but something that especially comes to mind now is it is the awareness that arises, right, without judgment. And again, I think all the other pieces are of course important, but maybe less so in terms of the end goal. That awareness without judgment is where we want to take this. And that could be, and I think that's where I will say that these questions are so helpful. And maybe it's more investigative. I like that word you used, investigative inquiry into what is happening in awareness, but not investigative questions that are judgments, if that makes sense.
So right, like, that's a good, yeah.
Why is this happening? What is happening? Mm-hmm. Why, what, where, when, you know, I guess those mm-hmm. kind of questions. And again, just continuing to sort of meditate on that. And maybe that's the direct path self-inquiry component of this, is meditating on the fact that what you ultimately are is awareness that does not judge, that is just aware. Because mm-hmm. for awareness, basically that judgments coming into anything isn't awareness, it's ego. Mm-hmm. It is just a different way of being that isn't awareness. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. So to wrap it up, what you said just made me think about how, you know, people talk now about how being a good listener means listening to understand. Listening to understand, not like listening to judge or listening to respond or listening to refute. And self-inquiry, actually, like doing all of this stuff, is a way of listening to yourself in an effort to understand, not to judge. And I mean, for me, that was ultimately the thing that I feel like led to my freedom from the shame of abortion and that story, is that I stopped judging myself and I sought only to understand. And if we can sort of treat ourselves like that, you know, like a child or like, you know, something that is just wanting deeply to be understood. It's like you, like if you have a dog that is, you know, doing something, like you, I mean, if you're nice, you try really hard to understand what your pet is telling you. You're like, okay, do you want to go outside? Are you hungry? Like, or your baby, right? You have this newborn baby and it's like, they can't talk. And you try 1,000 things to figure out, why are they crying? You're not judging them for crying. You're just like, I want to understand what is, like, what's wrong? What, how can I help you? And I think if we treat ourselves like that, like sweet newborn or, you know, whatever, then that's what we're going for. We're not judging. We're just seeking to understand and listening to that's our gift to ourselves, is listening to ourselves to understand, not listening to judge. Oh, I like this quote a lot. I really like this. Thanks for bringing Jon Kabat-Zinn into our lives, Dave. All right. And with that, I guess we will say goodbye. If anyone has any other thoughts on this quote, please send us an email at frombelievingtobeing@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. And yeah, we'll check in with you guys later. All right. Take care.